You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we talk about what infertility is like for men who want to become fathers, look at causes and treatments, and why we don't talk more about men's experiences of infertility. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about noticing the trees.
Sometimes we can take the world's beauty for granted. We don't notice these natural works of wonder that are in front of us every single day, until we do. For writer Catherine Jago, it took a global pandemic to open her eyes to the trees that surrounded her in Madison.
I came to know them during that unreal, anxious first summer of the pandemic, when it seemed that all I did, apart from commando-style grocery shopping and Zoom meetings in my basement, was walk. Morning and evening, I did loops around our residential neighborhood, alone, with my husband, or with friends. One day in June, I stopped short in the street, interrupting my husband's story to ask, "What's that heavenly smell?" Puzzled, because we couldn't see any source for the exquisite, subtle scent, I looked up. A big shade tree spread over us, with heart-shaped leaves, and when I looked more closely, sprigs of barely discernible blossom. I pulled one to my nose and inhaled. They smelled like orange blossom and jasmine. The flowers were tiny drooping clusters, the color of champagne, tattered and insubstantial as scraps of antique lace. I went home and looked up the tree. It was a basswood, a type of linden. After that, I saw basswoods and their cousins, the little leaf lindens, on every street. I remembered noticing them before in May, when they drop thousands of papery, pale green wings that pile up, thick as confetti, on the sidewalk. But in my 35 years in Wisconsin, I'd never thought to identify the tree or noticed them flowering. On the day before the summer solstice, I paused under a massive linden that enveloped the sidewalk like a perfumed green cave. It was loud with humming, every floret being worked by insects. Lindens, I read that week, are sometimes called bee trees because pollinators love them. My favorite local honey has long been basswood with its mild floral sweetness. It also happens that my favorite herbal tea is made from linden leaves and blossoms. It's the tea that Marcel Proust was drinking with his famous Madeleine, the scent that unlocked his memories of lost time. Lindens have long been associated with love, fertility, peace, and healing. In Greek mythology, they were the tree of Aphrodite, the goddess of love and beauty. In Roman, Norse, and Germanic cultures, they symbolized marital love and fidelity. Lindens are so central to some European cultures that the months when they flower are named after them. The word for June in Croatian is lipanj, linden blossom time. The Polish and Ukrainian words for July, lipiec and lipanj, mean the same thing. I felt humbled that I'd only just learned when the lindens flower here in Madison. I think more and more now about the generosity of trees, their beauty, scent, shade, nourishment, their slow wisdom, their endurance. I've begun to think of lindens in relation to the Midwest, calm, not showy, understated, with flowers that are discreet and easy to miss, and also married love, because it's been on my daily walks with my husband that I met these trees. And my appreciation for them and for him and for this place we've made home has only grown and deepened over time.
Catherine Jago is a writer based in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Sarah Hopeful was the technical director for this story. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. Polling shows that most men want to become dads someday. But when men are having trouble conceiving, there isn't always as much support for them as women who are struggling to become moms. Not even a lot of research on how not being able to become a dad affects men psychologically. A UW infertility expert joins us now to look at the causes and some of the treatments for male infertility. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Have you or your partner experienced infertility? What was it like? Can you talk about the process of seeking treatment? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Daniel Williams is a professor, a residency program director, and vice chair for education for the Department of Urology at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He specializes in men's infertility and sexual health. Dr. Williams, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks very much for having me today.
How common is infertility for men?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, we hear a lot about infertility on the female side and for couples in general. It's about 10 to 15% of couples of reproductive age are faced with fertility every year here in the U.S. And what's interesting about that is that although much of the attention is focused on the female side, as men, we can play a part in this problem as well. Sometimes that problem is overlooked, but upwards of about half the time when couples are being evaluated for fertility issues, we find something on the male side that's going on.
I looked, there's a long list of possible causes of male infertility. What are some of the most common ones?
Yeah, it's a great question. Issues on the male side can range from problems with the production of sperm, problems with the delivery of sperm for where it needs to go. Sometimes we find genetic abnormalities that contribute to fertility issues on the male side. But what we're really looking for when we do these evaluations for the male partner is making sure that there's not anything harmful going on, and also to see if there's something we can identify and treat to help that couple improve their fertility chances.
Yeah, what are some of the things that are potentially harmful to a guy who's experiencing infertility, where this is a symptom of something maybe hazardous?
Yeah, great question. Fortunately, it's quite rare that we find something harmful to that man during a fertility evaluations, but some of the things that we find that could be health-threatening or even life-threatening would be things like testicular cancer, which overall is quite rare, but sometimes men with testicular cancer present as having fertility problems. And then another relatively rare thing, but potentially concerning thing, would be a brain tumor that affects the man's pituitary gland, which is the hormone control center in our brain. And sometimes we find pituitary problems in men as they present with infertility.
I don't want to worry people. Those are fairly rare, you said.
That's correct. Yeah, it's quite rare that we find these harmful things. But really, much of the focus of the male fertility evaluation is on what the underlying cause or causes are, and if they are things that can be treated.
Now, we see in the news the Robert De Niro's of the world and Al Pacino's of the world becoming dads at a very advanced age. But aging can have impacts on fertility, I understand. What do we see there?
Yes, that's a very important point. It's good to, at some levels, it's sometimes good to see, what's going on in the overall world with fertility. But I think it's more the exception rather than the rule that men of advanced paternal age are looking to have kids. Historically, it was thought that that men can have kids until they're well into their 70s and 80s. Which, as we see in some of these high-profile folks, is possible. However, if you look at the impact of age and time on male fertility, men's overall fertility declines with age, number one. But number two, which I think is also important to keep in mind, is that the quality of men's sperm it does also decline over time. And what we're trying to figure out in a lot of areas of research is what potential impact advanced paternal age, meaning old men, what effect, if any, that has on the offspring as far as potential genetic abnormalities or health conditions that may be associated with an older man and older sperm.
We're talking about men's experiences with infertility and causes, and coming up maybe some treatments with Dr. Daniel Williams, professor of urology at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, and expert in male infertility. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Did you have a rocky road to fatherhood yourself? Have you undergone infertility treatment and you're willing to share that story with us? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about the experiences of men dealing with infertility, the effort to become a dad. Our guest is Dr. Daniel Williams, professor of urology at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, an expert in male infertility. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. John is with us in Eau Claire. John, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thank you for taking my call. Thank you for this really, really needed topic. I was actually, my wife and I were struggling with fertility and found a late adult case of cystic fibrosis that I had already always had. And then that helped my brother and his family and my family have kids through IVF. And I'm wondering how common is that? And is that something that is looked at with male infertility as well?
Interesting, John. Dr. Williams, is that something you've come across?
Absolutely. That's a great question, John. Thank you for bringing that that topic up. So with cystic fibrosis, as you and your family are aware, you need to have two genes of cystic fibrosis to have the disease cystic fibrosis. So there are a number of men and women out there who carry one cystic fibrosis gene, but not the double gene, if you will, to have the disease cystic fibrosis. So a number of men who carry cystic fibrosis genes have certain abnormalities in the reproductive tract that cause blockages. So, for example, the vas deferens tube is a tube that carries the sperm through the reproductive tract. And a lot of men who have cystic fibrosis and who are carriers of cystic fibrosis can be missing those tubes. So their bodies are producing sperm, but they're just trapped inside. And so, as you stated, we can do what are called sperm retrieval procedures to get sperm from the man and use those sperm for treatment with in vitro fertilization. And so for men with that cystic fibrosis condition, there are treatment options most of the time to help them out.
John, thanks a lot for sharing that experience with us. We'll go now to Brooke, also in Eau Claire. Brooke, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to ask about?
So my significant other, he actually just started testosterone replacement. He's been dealing with low testosterone for quite a while. And they told us not to get pregnant while on testosterone. But I've read some conflicting information, and I wanted to know your suggestions.
Oh, interesting. So links between testosterone use, Dr. Williams, and a sperm production.
Yeah, thank you, Brooke, for that question. This is a very hot topic in the male fertility world and in the men's health world in general. In general, we're starting to see a rise in the number of men who are on testosterone treatments. There are a number of reasons for that. Sometimes it's just more of an awareness of it and a better detection of men with low testosterone. But it's a very, very important notion, the idea of testosterone treatments in men with low testosterone. So when men have low testosterone and symptoms from low testosterone, a lot of men do benefit from raising those levels. But if you give a man one of the number, there are many different types of testosterone treatments, but if you give a man testosterone, it does raise his level of testosterone. And most men do feel better going from low to normal. But one important thing that's oftentimes not discussed is that any external testosterone treatment can and does lower sperm production. And in some men, it lowers it down to zero, completely suppresses it. So if a man does have low testosterone, and depending on what the cause of that low testosterone is, if that man is trying to preserve his fertility, there are other treatments that can boost a man's own production of testosterone to help him feel better and to maintain his sperm production. That's a very good question and something that's not always fully understood by many providers and by folks undergoing these treatments. So thank you for that question.
Thanks for calling in, Brooke. Dr. Williams, we don't often talk about male infertility, as you said, in general. How about the emotional and mental health side of things for the patients you deal with? Is this something that people are even talking about?
Yeah, that's another great point. Thank you, Rob. So the fertility journey for most couples can be quite a stressful one. There can be a lot of highs and lows of the emotional journey of having trouble to get pregnant, the stress of being evaluated, what's found or not found during the evaluations. And kind of stereotypically, it was always thought that, men are tough and they can handle whatever's thrown at them. But we're starting to learn more and more about the emotional impact of a man being diagnosed with fertility problems. We know that, yes, the majority of the time there is a female factor going on that's affecting a couple's fertility. But about a third of the time, it's solely the man's issue with a problem with the sperm or sperm production. And for a lot of men, that can be a very devastating blow emotionally to them. We do see a number of men develop depression after being diagnosed with infertility issues. We see a number of men who develop sexual dysfunction after they're diagnosed or while they're being evaluated. And for many couples, it puts a significant stress on the couple's emotional well-being and relationships. And so this is something that more and more, we're with just more and more awareness of the male fertility issues that men are and couples are understanding. But yes, it can be quite an emotional time for couples and for men struggling with male fertility.
Dr. Williams, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You bet. A pleasure to be here. And thank you to you and your team, Rob.
That's Dr. Daniel Williams, Professor, Residency Program Director, and Vice Chair for Education for the Department of Urology at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us today for a look at men's experiences of infertility. Now, a year ago this weekend, the U.S. Supreme Court issued its historic opinion that overturned decades of abortion policy. In Wisconsin, an 1800s-era law took effect, immediately banning effectively all abortions in the state. As Bridget Bowden reports, 1 year after the Dobbs decision, things look quite a bit different for Wisconsin on both sides of the issue.
On a recent morning near Madison, Planned Parenthood nurse Heather Ellingson is packing up her car. Every week for the last year, she's made the two-hour drive to the Planned Parenthood clinic in Waukegan, Illinois. It normally takes about 2 hours, except when the weather doesn't cooperate.
During the winter, there were some days where, just the weather was a bit brutal.
For Ellingson, making the trip just makes sense.
Because most of these are our patients. So many people, patients from Wisconsin, we see in Waukegan. And had the Dobbs decision not happened, we would have been seeing them here in Wisconsin.
And recent data from Illinois bears that out. The Planned Parenthood clinics there have seen a 54% increase in abortion patients since last summer, many of them coming from other states. And that means another fixture of abortion clinics is also making the trip, protesters.
And so we came from Wisconsin to Illinois to try to reach out to women who are abortion-minded.
That's Anne Franchek of Milwaukee. She's been protesting at abortion clinics for close to 40 years. Now she comes down twice a week with anti-abortion posters and models of fetuses.
And I put this in a baby stroller to make it more real that these are babies.
Jenny Higgins is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at UW-Madison and the director of the Collaborative for Reproductive Equity. She says despite all of the people traveling to states where abortion is still legal, the numbers haven't evened out.
What we've seen is while less restrictive states such as Illinois and Minnesota have seen increases in the number of abortions, those increases do not make up for the decreases in restrictive states such as Wisconsin.
It's too soon to know how the ban is affecting birth rates in the state. But Higgins says when abortion clinics in Appleton and Green Bay closed, they went up, and she expects we'll see the same thing now.
So I can say with a lot of certainty that we will expect slight but significant increases in birth rates in the Wisconsin counties that have lost the most access to care.
Although abortion access has been reduced significantly in the state, not much has changed for some Wisconsinites. Before the ban, Wisconsin had 4 abortion clinics located in Madison, Milwaukee, and Sheboygan. Cheryl Thede is the president of the Options Fund, a group that provides financial assistance for abortion seekers in northwestern Wisconsin. They were already helping people get over the border, she says. What's changed is the pressure on out-of-state clinics.
The states where it's legal now are carrying the burden of people from the other states. Mm-hmm. And so there is a little bit more of a lead time with appointments in Minnesota and Illinois as people from Texas and Louisiana and all sorts of states are traveling.
The future of abortion in Wisconsin may come down to the state Supreme Court, which will now have a liberal majority after Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge Janet Protasiewicz was elected to an open seat in April. Matt Sandy is the legislative director of Pro-Life Wisconsin. He remembers celebrating the Dobbs decision a year ago, but doesn't believe anti-abortion work is done.
Yes, we've been abortion-free for a year. But abortion could be coming back in the near future.
Back in the car, Planned Parenthood nurse Heather Ellingson is also looking toward the future, but she hopes abortion access will be restored.
I was present when we had to close our door, and I would like to be there and swing that door right back open and be like, nope, we are ready, waiting. We are capable. We've kept up our skills and welcome our patients right back the very minute.
It's expected the court could take up the abortion case as soon as August. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, chronic wasting disease has been a growing problem for years in Wisconsin's deer herd. Check out the latest news about the spread of the disease and efforts to control it. And there have been air quality problems in communities around Wisconsin, including an ongoing advisory for ozone right now for a lot of the state. It's coming from smoke from Canadian wildfires. Check out the science behind the smoke and what it means for our health. And we want to hear from you. Is this affecting your life, your decisions to go outside? Are you at risk because of poor air quality? Let us know about it. You can email right now, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Then join the conversation that's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll check out Secretary of State Antony Blinken's recent diplomatic visit to China and what it could mean for the difficult international relationship. First, sound familiar? That's the sound of city traffic from the inside of a car, roughly 80 to 85 decibels. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that city noises while in a car are loud enough to annoy you, possibly damage hearing after hours of exposure. Being too close to sirens on the road? The CDC says standing beside or near 120 decibel sirens is enough to cause pain and permanent ear injury. And that's all in the short run. In the long run, chronic noise exposure can be risky for our health in a variety of ways, not just hearing, but our heart, our cardiovascular system in general. You could join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you live or work in a noisy environment? Do you live in a busy city street, say? Tell us about your experience, and what would you like to know about the impact of exposure to loud noises? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Charlie Roscoe is a postdoctoral fellow researching environmental health at Harvard University and the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. She was one of a group of experts consulted in a new series in the New York Times on noise pollution. Charlie, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Before we dig into some of the studies that you've worked on, can you talk a little bit about the potential long-term health impacts of noise pollution? I think we might be annoyed by noise. We might worry about our hearing in particular. What kind of things do we know so far about how it can help affect our health in the long run?
Yeah, absolutely. So long-term traffic noise is my focus of research, and that has been associated with cardiovascular disease outcomes, and they can be acute events like having a heart attack or a stroke, or they can be more long-term kind of coronary heart disease and diagnoses associated with cardiovascular diseases, atherosclerosis. So that's when your arteries get kind of hardened, and that's all been linked to noise. But a lot of that research has come from Europe rather than from the U.S.
Why haven't we studied this as much in the U.S.? I'm certainly we have as many noisy environments as Europe does, I imagine.
Oh, we definitely do have noisy environments here. I would say the reason that we haven't studied this so much in the U.S. is mainly just because of the noise estimates. So when we want to look at something like cardiovascular disease, or we want to look at cancer, or we want to look at one of those diseases where it takes kind of a long time to accumulate that chronic, you know, cumulative exposure that might harm our health over time, then what we need to do when we're thinking about exposure is not just look at like, what were we exposed to today or yesterday or last week? We need to look, you know, 20 or 30 years in the past. And that takes a very concerted modeling effort. So usually if it's kind of policy focused in terms of let's reduce noise now in neighborhoods, the government is going to really be focused on what the noise is right now and has been quite recently and how to get that down. Whereas when we're doing epidemiological studies, so when we want to study the occurrence of disease, we need to go much further back in time and have a historical exposure model. So we want to go back 20, 30 years. And we have produced those in Europe. And then we've looked at that with cardiovascular disease in certain study designs, which allow us to really try and tease out if there is an association that's meaningful and potentially causal, or if it's, you know, just noise and it's associated with something else in the environment like air pollution. But what we have for the first time currently in the US is a model that is quite good and historic. And we've looked at it with a cohort that's long running since the 80s. So that was why I was invited to talk with the New York Times and tell them about that research, which is not peer reviewed yet, I will say, but our initial findings are that we do see an association of noise, anthropogenic noise specifically, with cardiovascular outcomes in our cohort study.
I wanted to ask you about this research because it would seem to me like studying the long-term health impacts of noise would be particularly hard to do. Can you talk about how you used long-term data, what group you were looking at, how this study came together?
Yeah, absolutely. So this was a study in the long-running nurses' health study. And the nurses' health study is a cohort of nurses who initially responded with a questionnaire, just kind of their demographics and what their current health status was in 1976. And then the cohort followed these women over time. Every 2 years, they returned a questionnaire, and it had a lot of different questions eventually on all of these questionnaires. And they would say, you know, what they were eating. They said where they lived. They said what, you know, health outcomes they've had in the last couple of years since we last spoke to them. And we were able then to look at their noise exposure since 1988 and look over time if noise was associated with their cardiovascular outcomes. And you might be thinking, okay, but noise is, you know, linked to lots of these other things in the environment. So in this kind of study, we want to account for all of the information they're giving us that might be relevant to their cardiovascular health. So do they exercise? Do they eat well? Do they, you know, take general good care of their health and go for their checkups? Or, you know, what hormone replacement therapy are they on? Various things that we think, okay, maybe that could be, you know, linked to the outcome, or it could be linked to both the exposure, so the noise exposure and the outcome, for instance, air pollution. So if traffic creates air pollution and noise at the same time, then we need really good models to kind of tease out, is it the air pollution or is it the noise? And we make sure that we try to account for all of that when we're modeling noise and cardiovascular disease. And if we still see an association after we've accounted for all of those other things, then we say, okay, this is probably something real. And it does correspond very well to what's been shown in Europe, where we have kind of a little bit better noise models developed there. In terms of what I'm saying by good modeling is we want the noise specifically at your residential address, like right outside your front door or your back door. We want to know what kind of noise you're really kind of experiencing, maybe at nighttime and in the daytime. And to do that, we kind of model very fine scale. And the models in the US are good, but they were created initially for a different purpose. So they were created by the National Park Service because there is an ordinance that national parks cannot be too noisy. And then they were like, okay, well, we have this kind of procedure set up to measure noise. Why don't we extend this to urban areas so that we can get a full coverage of the contiguous US and see what the noise levels are, or predict the noise levels as well as we can in those areas. So they extended that out, and that's what we currently have in the US. It's not quite as good as what's available in Europe, but I think that's what's taken us a little bit of time to get going on the research in the US on noise, but we are working towards better modeling, and we probably will see more studies coming out with cardiovascular disease and other outcomes also, you know, sleep and other things like that.
We're talking about the health impacts of noise pollution with Charlie Roscoe, researcher at Harvard University and the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you live in a noisy environment or work in a noisy environment? What is it? Does it keep you awake at night? How does it make you feel, apart from maybe annoyed? What questions do you have about the connections between noise pollution and our long-term well-being? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Charlie, what are the thoughts on why, you know, being exposed to noise pollution at a chronic level could lead to these other effects? Is it sleep? Is it stress? What's going on?
Yeah, there are lots of different theories, and there are kind of animal models and more short-term models on kind of exposing humans and seeing what happens in their body when they're exposed to noise. And the most commonly cited mechanism is kind of, even if you're not consciously aware of noise, so, you know, even if you do sleep through noise in the night because you're used to it because it's outside your bedroom window every single night, then like actually your body might still be reacting even without a conscious reaction. So basically we fire off kind of a stress response in our body to noise, even if we don't feel actually stressed, you know, we don't perceive the stress. And then this kind of firing can over time produce glucocorticoids and other things that lead to insulin resistance and metabolic problems. And then on top of that, we also have the kind of conscious, you know, element of noise is annoying for a lot of us. That might raise our stress levels. It might interrupt our sleep. Sleep is essential for many bodily processes. Sleep is linked to inflammation. Sleep is also linked to how much physical activity you do the next day. So it's kind of this vicious cycle of, if we're exposed to a lot of noise, maybe consciously, we're frustrated. We're also like not doing the things that are best for our body because we're feeling a bit exhausted by this. And then on top of that, we have this non-conscious kind of mechanism happening as well in the background.
Talking to Charlie Roscoe, a postdoctoral fellow researching environmental health at Harvard University and the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, looking at research on the health impacts of noise pollution. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a noise in your neighborhood that consistently annoys you, bothers you, maybe even keeps you up at night? Join in at 800-642-1234 to share your story of encounters with noise pollution. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation on the health effects of living around noise pollution. Our guest is Charlie Roscoe, postdoctoral fellow researching environmental health at Harvard University and the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you or have you lived with noise pollution? Do you have health issues, do you think, from noise exposure? Tell us about it. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Kim is with us in Madison. Kim, hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for the show. I live under the flight path, and the commercial jets are loud enough. I mean, they're horrible. And now the F-35s are, you know, unbelievably loud. And I wear a Fitbit, and I notice that many commercial flights, the F-35s are in a class of their own, but many commercial flights have this loud, like, whining noise as they're landing. And on my Fitbit, my heart rate goes way up and stays up for a couple of hours, and this assault goes on. So I was really interested to see the New York Times article last week. And what I'm wondering is, you know, I retired, so I notice it even more now. And, you know, is your guest aware of like class action lawsuits? We have great politicians in a lot of ways, but Tammy Baldwin, Joe Parisi, Satya, you know, what's her name? None of them seem to give a hoot. And my property taxes sure haven't gone down.
Kim, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Now, Charlie, the legal side of things, I know you're probably not an expert on, but is there research onto a source of noise like jets, commercial and military jets in a neighborhood?
Absolutely. And we want to make sure that we're providing that research that really is providing information so that policymakers can make the right decisions. And there is a lot more focus on air pollution than there is on noise. And we know a lot of people are affected by noise. That's super interesting with the kind of Fitbit and being able to see the heart rate variability. I found that fascinating. And we also do have studies where we use Fitbits, mainly focusing on sleep and physical activity. But it would be really interesting to see the noise and like how that heart rate variability changes. That actually would be a fantastic study. But yeah, in terms of policy, again, like I said, Europe has more studies, and kind of the WHO in the Europe part of the WHO has a lot of publications, if you're interested, on specific limits that we should set for noise, for traffic, for rail, and for aircraft. And aircraft, especially during the night, is something that they focus on. There have been studies on aircraft and cardiovascular outcomes and hypertension in the Nurses Health Study by one of my colleagues and co-authors. So you could take a look at that as well. But definitely, this is an area where I think we need more evidence. And even the evidence that we already have, we don't have any reason to really believe that, you know, noise from an aircraft affects someone in one continent differently than it affects someone in another continent. So we really can start pushing at least our local politicians and our state politicians to kind of think about making some kind of action to reduce noise. And in terms of, you know, trying to get noise exposure down for ourselves, maybe wearing earplugs, or, you know, I wear earplugs. I live near a very busy road, and it's not ideal, you know, but if it takes a while for policy to catch up, then we can do whatever we can for our own health.
Thanks for the call, Kim. Karen joins us now in Reidsville. Karen, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering about local machines. My neighbors have these huge tractor lawn mowers, and everybody mows at different times of the day, and some of these mowers are so obnoxious that it feels like the air is vibrating. And on occasion, usually about once a week, I have to actually leave my house to go someplace quiet.
Karen, thanks for the call. Charlie, does a good solid lawnmower that a neighbor has rise to the level that it could have health impacts with repeated exposure?
Sure. I honestly don't know too much about lawnmowers specifically, but I've definitely read something in the New York Times about leaf blowers and the kind of pollution from those, but also the noise pollution, the air pollution mixed together. So yeah, I do think any kind of noise, usually there's ordinances in place, at least for like nighttime in terms of your neighbor being noisy. So I would definitely look into that and see if there is anything in your area that you can kind of call somebody. But that does sound, there's no reason to think that high levels of noise from any source that's kind of an annoyance to you isn't going to affect your health in some way if it's really repeated and over time. And that sounds really incredibly annoying.
Karen, thanks for the call. Ellen is with us now in La Crosse. Ellen, hello.
Hi, yes. I used to live on a very busy four-way stop in La Crosse, and actually the large trucks downshifting to stop at the stop sign was something that would wake me up all the time overnight. And it was a priority for me when I moved that I actually moved to a quiet neighborhood and not a very busy street. And I was so surprised how much more peaceful it is. And I think I took it for granted. I didn't realize how much I was suffering from that. But then I just had a question about, too, where larger affordable housing is being built, maybe subsidized housing, you know, are they looking at these units being built next to really large and busy highways? Is that more cost effective? And like, is noise pollution going to affect lower income folks more because these large complexes are maybe being built in not very peaceful spots?
Ellen, thanks a lot for the call. Charlie, I know the socioeconomic difference is a point of interest for you. Can you talk a little bit about how low-income people might be more vulnerable to noisy environments?
Absolutely. And I just want to say I also live on a very busy four-way intersection, and it is incredibly loud and disruptive. And whenever I like leave the state and go and stay somewhere else that's quieter, I have better sleep and I feel so much better and well-rested and able to do my work properly the next day. So I completely, on an anecdotal level, feel you there. In terms of the low SES, low socioeconomic status housing, I really feel that even if you like look at Zillow, there's kind of walk scores, and more recently there's kind of, maybe it's on Redfin, but there's, you know, there's like noise scores now, and it is something that we humans really, really do seek out peace and quiet for our home. And that is not available to everybody. It costs us money to have that. It really costs us money in terms of rent or in terms of house prices to live in an area that's quieter. And with the low socioeconomic status housing, if that is built on busy highways, you know, with bad air pollution and noise and not much green space to kind of get out and about and enjoy nature, and all of these things kind of, you can imagine, cumulatively can really add on to the already, you know, the socioeconomic burden that these people are enduring. And then on top of that, you have all these kind of environmental assaults. And, you know, you can imagine that there's some interaction there.
Thanks a lot for the call, Ellen, and the question. Charlie, in our last minute or so, what kind of research are you hoping to see, especially here in the United States, to catch up with European research? What do we need to be looking at here?
Yeah, I personally would like to work on producing better noise estimates. Those noise estimates were great for the purpose that they were made, and I would really, really like to, you know, get those really, really accurate, at least as accurate as the air pollution exposure that we have for the US, which is very good. And then we can really kind of tease out what is from noise, traffic noise, and what is air pollution, what's affecting health, what do we need to modify, what do those policymakers really need to do to give us healthy environments to thrive in.
Charlie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Charlie Roscoe, postdoctoral fellow researching environmental health at Harvard University and the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. We've been talking about the health impacts of noise pollution. You can keep sharing your experiences with noise in your neighborhood or maybe your workplace. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page and tell us about it. And are there changes you'd like to see in your community when it comes to noise regulation, when it comes to how laws are enforced, if they exist in the first place? Let us know. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up after the news, we'll look at the difficult diplomatic relationship between the United States and China and what Secretary of State Antony Blinken's recent visit with Chinese leaders did to try to calm down those tensions. Join in, as always, with your questions and your thoughts on what you'd like to see happen. Email ideas@wpr.org. Remember, you can follow these conversations all the time, anytime, online at wpr.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. You can stream our networks live, and you can go back and listen to archive programs and share your favorite ones with your friends along the way. Again, online at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.